States Senate. Today is Wednesday, March 3rd, 2004. It's now about 5 minutes after the hour of 8 a.m. Members that are here, Senator Terrio, Senator Ogun, Senator French, myself, Senator Seekins, Senator Ellis is excused. We're going to look at a number of items on today's agenda. The first item we're going to look at will be Senate Bill 333, an act relating to judicial relief before final administrative decisions of state agencies. And we do have a new version to take a look at this morning, everyone should have a copy of, which is /hotel. Senator Terrio?
Chairman, I would move the H version as the working document before the committee.
Is there objection?
I object for purposes of explanation of what the changes are.
Okay, Senator Terrio?
I should probably just have Mr. Stancliffe come forward.
Mr. Stancliffe, would you come up and put yourself on the record? And you heard Senator Ogun's inquiry there?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Dave Stancliffe, staff to the Admin Reg Review Committee. This particular item was before the committee, and there was discussion concerning whether or not the regulatory clock should continue to run while the court might be considering an extrication process, and the feeling from the committee expressed at that time was that it should. That has been taken care of in page 2, lines 24, 25, basically indicates that the state agency shall continue with the administrative proceedings unless, and then number 1 and number 2 are the unlesses, and that would indicate that unless there was official action taken by the court, a process that might speed up or get worked out with this type of elevated attention would continue to run. Now, the other thing I might add is the title has been changed to address the fact that we are now changed administrative, state's administrative procedures. So the title now conforms with the change, and the change is, as I have stated, on page 2.
All right. Questions?
Mr. I remove my objection. Thank you.
Objection has been removed. We are now considering the H version of CS for Senate Bill number 333. And are there questions of Mr. Stancliffe at the moment on the remainder of the bill? Stancliffe, one could anticipate, since we have now told the administration that the clock keeps ticking, that there will be motions to stop the clock by the court based on the court's calendar, I would imagine.
That would be a fair assumption, Mr. Chairman.
We'll have to see how the court starts to handle those things, see what the routine becomes down the road. Other questions on the bill?
Just one.
Senator French.
I asked at the last hearing, and I don't know if you had any luck finding out how long an administrative proceeding takes, and I don't know if you have any feel for what the average length of an administrative proceeding is, what the longest is, what the shortest is. I think we heard what the longest one was from Alaska Regional Hospital folks who were engaged in a problem for many years, but I'm wondering how long the shortest one is and what the median is.
Mr. Chairman, we have that information being compiled right now by the House or the Legislative Research Agency. It is not complete, but it's nearly complete, and as soon as it is, with your permission, and I'd be happy to share that report with you. And it goes actually through agency by agency, shows the number of cases they've handled, approximately how many a year, and how many have been open in excess of a year, and how long they've been open. We're hoping not to have to do a full-blown audit to get the information, but slowly it is trickling in. So would you like me to provide you with that?
I'd be happy to. That's why I asked the question. Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
Other questions? Hearing none, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on this bill this morning, either online here in Juneau? Is anyone online? No additional testimony. Wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio.
I move the committee substitute for Senate Bill 333 from committee with the indeterminate fiscal note with...
there objection?
I'll object.
Call the roll.
Senator Terrio?
Yes.
Senator French?
No.
Senator Ogden?
Yes.
Senator Seeky?
Yes. So this bill, Senate Bill 333, version H, is moved to the Finance Committee as the next referral, committee of referral. I'd like to move next to tab number 5, if it's tabbed, or HB 31, HJR 5. Our next consideration this morning for the committee. Okay, do we have some representative Williams here this morning as a sponsor? Anyone here?
Let's just pick up 217 and call over there.
Why don't we, I'll have Mr. Hove call and see if we can get someone. In the meantime, let's move to Senate Bill 217. Senator Olson.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee this morning.
Chairman, I'm Donald Olson, Senator that's sponsoring Senate Bill 217.
Welcome to the committee. Do you have any opening comments this morning, Senator?
Good to be here again. Obviously, the reason for the bill was felt that under current law there was inadequate protection and definition of the patient's right or a individual's right to their genetic information, and because of this abuse could be perceived and not actually done to the individual as well as their blood relatives, and because of that I introduced the legislation basically for that reason.
Okay. Additional questions for the senator? Senator, I have one question, and we discussed it just very briefly in the last time we heard the bill. The question I have is one of personal conviction and philosophy, I guess. It comes down to, if we are going to prohibit the activities or restrict the activities as proposed in this bill for private industry, why would we not do the same for government entities?
Mr. Chairman, that's actually a very good question, partly because there are many of us that are somewhat apprehensive about some of the actions that government agencies can take. And there are other issues that can be brought up besides what we're trying to do with this bill as far as how it relates to government agencies. Now, because of that, there are already statutes on the book, in particular Alaska Statute 09.5.20, 09.65.70, which have to do with actionable claims against the state. And with that, there are protections for the individual to do that. And these statutes cover everything there that is not covered under the exemptions that are outlined in this particular bill.
Okay. So when I like the idea that this that our statutes would say a person, and in that definition, I don't believe that includes a government agency. I would say may not collect a DNA sample from a person, perform a DNA analysis on a sample, retain a DNA sample, or the results of a DNA analysis, or disclose the results of a DNA analysis unless the person or the government agency has first obtained the informed written. I'm just really nervous about that. I understand the exceptions are there for identification and crime prevention. I don't have a problem with that. But, you know, I wouldn't want the Health and Social Services Agency to be able to collect DNA without the same restrictions that I would put on an insurance company. I just don't trust that bureaucrats, I'm not using that term derogatorily, but as a term of definition, should be able to not suffer the same pain or penalty that private industry would if they made private information available.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ogden.
Now, I think an example of that can be, and I concur with your analysis that we shouldn't necessarily trust the government just because we're the government and we're here to help you.
Very well put.
I can recall a few campaigns ago when public safety personnel, people had access to the APSIN system, looked at records of people that were running for office, and primarily Republicans, that in order to see if there was any criminal records, and it was an abuse of the system, and it was already illegal, and I know somebody in on a police force, a local police force, that was disallowed access to the absence system for quite some time after that for doing that with me. So there's the potential for government to abuse the systems that they have, and because government is run by human beings and that have the same same traits as everybody else. So, I share your concern.
Because later on in paragraph 2 there, line 11, we say DNA sample and the results of a DNA analysis performed on the sample are the exclusive property of. And I don't want to have implied anywhere in there, except if it's in the hands of a government agency. And I may be overreacting, but I prefer to overreact on the side of privacy for the individual than to allow what could be, arguably, and I'm not an attorney, and I haven't played one on TV, Senator Ogden, but a loophole there that could be used to the disadvantage of the people that we're trying to protect. That's my biggest concern. And so I would throw that on the table. Senator French, do you have your hand up, or are you just...
No, I'm actually I'm thinking about hearing from someone from DHSS who could tell us under what circumstances they gather samples, for what purposes, what they do with the information, and how they safeguard its dissemination. Because I think those are all good questions that I would need to know the answer to before I moved one way or another in what sounds like an amendment that's forming in your mind.
In my mind, I give great deference to the sponsor of a bill to discuss the issue to see what the intent of the author was. In my mind, I just have a check. And that is one of the things. I could imagine I could carry this to all kinds of extents. In order to get a driver's license, you have to give a DNA sample. What happens to it? That DNA sample. Senator Ogden.
Well, I'm looking at page 2, line 16, private right of action, and saying a person may bring a civil action against a person who collects DNA sample from a person, in violation of this chapter. And I guess we might need a legal interpretation of whether or not a government agency that takes samples included it as in the description of a person.
Well,
Senator French,
just thinking out loud, irrespective of whether the agency is at fault, that individual is still a person. You don't lose your personhood by going to work for the government. So if that person has illegally sold or transmitted or disseminated your information, if that's an identifiable human being, then you have a right of action against that person. And of course, the next question to ask is whether you feel like it's on the part of the agency is somehow at fault, whether they've adopted a policy of dissemination contrary to the law. whether they are going to be immune from suit or whether they're going to be amenable to suit based on this statute.
But if that person is acting, if the agency for which that person works is not restricted from disseminating that information, doesn't the aren't they kind of immune from any personal action that would be brought against them, since it's not against the policy of the agency to hold that information secret?
If it were me, I'd say that a statute trumps a policy. You know, you can have a policy, but if it's contrary to state law, then that doesn't get you off the hook. Maybe your policy to have, you know, five beers after work on Friday and drive home, but the trooper's still going to nab you.
So if the agency by law is not restricted, neither is the employee, is it?
If the agency by law is not restricted.
Is not required to keep the information confidential. Aren't they acting in respondeat superior if they're not?
Then I guess we need to hear from DHSS. We need to know if they have a policy of disseminating this information. Do they have a policy of spreading it around? Do they have a policy of giving it out? Do they have a policy of even taking the samples outside paternity, which we know CSED does quite a bit of, and whether they gather samples in any other settings. I mean, I think they have to go to the court every time they want to get a DNA sample to do paternity tests. It's pretty routine, but you don't just wave a magic wand and go get someone's blood. You've got to have an order to get it.
Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we get too far astray in this whole dialogue or discussion about what we're discussing here, certainly there are concerns. The main reason for the bill is to have some type of protection for the individual and his DNA. You start getting into issues like health and social services, which has valid concerns. The health and social services is not exempted from getting informed consent, and that's the main push of this bill, is to get informed consent. On page 2, we see that the Department of Health and Social Services has to get informed consent. What they do with it after that is not the focus of the bill. The bill is to protect the individual's rights. Now, that can be dealt with something. It has to be dealt with another vehicle, and that's not the intent of the bill, just to dictate how Health and Social Services is going to be doing. But just to assure you that Health and Social Services has got to get informed consent like any other entity would have to.
So there really isn't any structural reason why not to say a person or government agency. Okay. Senator Terrio.
Chairman, since Health and Social Services, we know, does this, particularly for paternity, do we know, is there another section of statutes that governs the way they gather and handle that information? Senator, do you know? And I know that one of the statements, I think it was made verbally, that this law, it's not our intent that this law necessarily supersede another collections, a set of statutes that allow collection elsewhere in the statute. But we haven't had much discussion about what other sections may exist. And then, Mr. Chairman, just when I was reading through this, I was a little bit confused as you jump from section to section, and it talks about person. In one section, it's the person who's collecting the sample, and the next section is the person being collected from, and I don't know if there's a way of just clearing that up.
I totally agree with the concept. I understand the concept, totally agree with it. I guess what I'm hoping to do in my own mind is to satisfy myself that we capture everyone that could possibly be a leak. That we plug every hole that's possible to protect the individual. So that's where I'm trying to roll. Senator Terrio, did you have let me just go before we go on too far, did you a letter of intent that... Senator Olson.
Chairman, could I just respond a little bit to what's going
Please.
On here? Obviously, I've told you what the intent of the bill is. If we were to go ahead and try and plug every leak, I think that we'd have some difficulty there. There are just too many leaks that are out there that certainly could, I guess I'm not familiar with any bill that plugs every leak. But to address the concern that Senator Terrio has, it's a very valid one, partly because there are other sections in state statute that deal with actionable claims against the state. And when you're starting to go get into that type of arena, then you're starting to become into a very convoluted and complex area that multiple lawyers get involved. And that takes away from what I'm trying to do with this particular bill.
I understand.
And if you start going down that road, then you got to change other statutes where you have this overlap. And then the confusion arises. And that's where obviously the lawyers have their, I wouldn't say heyday, but it becomes very, very complicated for the layperson.
Mr. Chairman, just
Senator Terrio.
Page 1 where it says, prohibitions in A of this section do not apply to DNA samples collected and analyzed, conducted, then one under 44-41-035. Is that the set of statutes that deals with the collection for paternity by the Health Department? So is that a specific exemption for them? And then, of course, it goes on to say all comparable provisions of another jurisdiction. That's the general language that says we don't mean this necessarily to trump every other set of statutes that allows for collection.
44-41.035 is being distributed to you now, and what it has to do with the exemptions they're having to do with law enforcement, public safety.
So I guess that.
And if I can just.
Senator French.
Thank you. If I can just point out, this is a DNA identification system. It's a statute I'm somewhat familiar with, and I would just point out that on the first page you have in front of you, under subsection F, it sort of tells you how the people that collect this data are restricted. It says the DNA identification registration system is confidential, is not a public record, and may be used only for, then it lists out the exact reasons. And it's basically for blood grouping, for law enforcement purposes, statistical blind analysis, for improving the operation of the system. We heard a fair amount of testimony about this last year when we were contemplating expanding the number of crimes that we would collect DNA for. And I think Chris Beheim from the State Crime Lab came down and gave us a good presentation about how tightly they keep track of those samples they get from criminals and suspects.
Senator Ogden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there anybody from the Department of Law here?
I don't see anyone.
I just want to state to the record that there's, in my opinion, been a disturbing absence of the Department of Law here all year. And all my years in judiciary on the other body. Generally, the Department of Law is represented at the table often, and I just haven't seen them this year. So,
we certainly can request someone from the Department of Law to comment on this. We can do that. That's not a problem. Other questions? Senator French.
It sounds like we're sort of stuck on a point that may never be ultimately resolved. I mean, I think the bill has been written to hit, you know, the 90% of the target, and I applaud the bill's author for being persistent. I think this is the third time it's been heard in committee, and I know it takes a lot of time to keep these bills moving forward. I think the bill is written clearly enough to give the public and the government a good idea about when they have to get informed consent to get a DNA sample. It specifically includes the Department of Health and Social Services, the DNA samples that are conducted under the current statutes are tightly regulated, and I think this bill also tightly regulates them. I guess I can't imagine a situation in which a government official thinking he has the right starts selling samples taken
from his agency to insurance companies, but that's, I guess that's something that a lawsuit and a quick firing would take care of, given the policy stated in this bill and the policy stated in 44, 41, 035. So I think the bill has been gone over with a fine-tooth comb and is in pretty good shape. And so it strikes me that it's ready for the next committee.
Well, my fine-tooth comb is a little closer between the teeth than yours at the moment, Senator French, but I'm just trying to bring myself to at peace with it. While I think about that, are there other questions on other sections of the bill? Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, just with regard to other jurisdictions, I appreciate having 4441 here, and I would imagine that any set of statutes, other set of statutes which we, so by reference, are exempting from this, probably speak to how the sample can be collected and what can be done with this with regards to confidentiality. So some of my concerns there are allayed. I'm just wondering, though, when we're talking about, it gives this specific statutory reference or comparable provision of another jurisdiction, what all gets swept in under other jurisdiction? Is that other state departments? And I don't know if Senator French or maybe somebody else here in the room can tell me what all is allowed by use of the phrase other jurisdiction. Would that be a local government? Is that an allowable jurisdiction, or is that phrase restricted just to other state agencies that might have separate statutes?
If I were just speaking off the top of my head, I would say it had
Senator
to be...
Senator French, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It would be a statute dealing specifically with a DNA identification system. And moreover, it would be a DNA identification system supervised by a Department of Public Safety. If it were something more like paternity or screening newborns or emergency medical treatment, it would fall under the other exceptions under subsection B. So it would be a DNA identification system, and I would say either conducted by the United States government for their law enforcement purposes or by another state.
Could it be a local government? I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Senator Terrio.
Allowable jurisdiction.
Speaking off the top of my head, I would say probably not, because it strikes me that there's no other local jurisdiction doing a DNA identification systems for criminal justice purposes, but I guess it's imaginable.
It could be local police department if I read this literally as it's constructed. It basically says that other jurisdiction, the prohibitions that don't apply under that statute or comparable provisions of another jurisdiction, which could be any subdivision of state government, including borough or state, depending on city, depending on whether they have a law enforcement. If it's for the purposes of law enforcement, including the identification of perpetrators, etc., for determining paternity, to screen newborns, or for the purposes of emergency medical treatment. So any other jurisdiction that said it was collecting it for any one of those four reasons, it appears to me, if...
Because it's got to be comparable to this statute.
Or comparable provisions. So if the city of Fairbanks or the municipality of Anchorage wanted to collect DNA from an individual for any one of these purposes, for comparable purposes.
I just disagree. That's too broad a reading. And
what is a comparable provision then?
It's got to be comparable to 44, 41, 035, which is about DNA identification for the purposes of public safety. That's what the statute
and
says.
And if the city of Fairbanks wanted to do it for that reason, they could.
Right, but they'd send their sample to the state crime lab, because unless you guys have started a DNA lab up there in Fairbanks, then all go to the state crime lab. That's why the statute.
And who holds the record?
The state does.
It doesn't get returned to the city, or doesn't get returned to the municipality.
You get a report to. Yeah, I can tell you how it works in the criminal justice setting. You send your buccal swab of your suspect and your swab from the crime scene off to the state crime lab, and they do their, you know, mumbo-jumbo, whatever it is they do. It takes a long time and you sweat the details about, and you get it back a couple days before trial, and it says, you know, we've got 100 pages of statistics. We'll come and show you about why our methods are perfect, and this is a match, or it's not a match. And so what you know, at least in the public record, is whether or not that swab matches that stain at the crime scene. So there's, I mean...
Then why have we got another jurisdiction in there? If it's meaningless, why is it in there?
I didn't say it was meaningless.
Chairman?
Senator Ogden.
I suggest that maybe at some point in the future... grows to be a big enough metropolis that they have their own DNA crime lab, as I'm sure some cities do in Lower 48, that they have the ability to do it as well. But they're still covered under 44.41.035 or comparable provisions. So
that's what I'm reading. That's how I'm reading it.
I agree with both. I think you're both right, frankly. I agree with all my friends all the time. So you.
No, you don't. But the... I see that. I guess the only thing I stick with is I want government to hold it as private as anybody else does. That's my only sticking point.
The sponsor's the same, Mr. Chairman.
Any other discussion, Senator Terry? Did you have a... is this the letter of intent that we've looked at? Have we adopted that?
No, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the prime sponsor statement of concern that we load the statutes up with intent unnecessarily. And so at the last meeting, it appeared that they had taken the whereases and pulled them into a paragraph. I didn't think it read very well, so, you know, I just jotted down some notes, had my staff type it up, and we gave that to the prime sponsor to take a look at. If they're comfortable with it, as far as it covering the intent, all of the intent, and being a clear statement, you know, I'd offer for the committee's review. I did notice, looking at it, though, there's a typo or incorrect English on the first line, which I'll take responsibility for. I think it talks about recent scientific breakthroughs in decoding DNA samples should be have,
right,
instead of has, because we're talking about breakthroughs, plural. It needs to be have, the end of the first line there. So I would suggest that change be made before the committee consider it.
Has the sponsor looked at this?
Actually, I have, Mr. Chairman.
And your opinion, sir?
It's very positive. It's concise, brings it to the point, and focuses on what I want to do with this bill without getting out into, because biotechnology is advancing so fast and the field is getting more and more complicated. If you don't get a handle on it now, I think the idea of trying to get something in the future is going to work against not just the residents of the state of Alaska. It's going to work against this legislature trying to get something on it.
Senator Ogden?
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, we've had a good discussion today, and, you know, we could probably split hairs over some definitions, but I think I personally would have a problem with the bill on it, but you're the chair.
It's going to move on to a committee in which the sponsor sits when it moves out of here, so I'm sure he'll have a lot of input into it at that point as well. Do we want to adopt this letter as a part of our committee record at this point in time? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, if we move the bill, then I would make a second motion or suggest that a second motion be made to move the intent language with it.
Okay.
And again, I appreciate the sponsors considering doing it this way, a letter of intent rather than load intent right. language into the statutes.
What we do have, one person that would like to testify on this bill before we take final committee action, and that is John George. John, would you like to come up and take a seat, put yourself on the record, and welcome once again to the committee, and we're eager to hear your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John George. I'm here today representing the American Council of Life Insurers. They testified at the last hearing and by teleconference, and there were several things I think that should be clarified. I noticed the committee eyes got real wide when they talked about insurers sharing information, health information. And we had testified before in other committees that the Division of Insurance has a privacy regulation they're in the process of adopting. It's not finalized yet, but it's very close to being adopted. Model follows very closely the National Association of Insurance Commissioners model. It follows very closely the National Conference of Insurance Legislators model on privacy of financial and health information. Both of those bodies and the Division of Insurance have recognized that there are very specific needs to share health information, and genetic information falls generically, I guess, under that title. Some of those reasons are for claims administration, adjustment, underwriting, guarantee fund functions, reinsurance purposes, risk management, case management, quality assurance for our consumers, actuarial, scientific, grievance procedures, internal administration of compliance, policy service, policyholder services, auditing. We have to be able to disclose that information to insurance regulators. We're subject to audit. Have to maintain records showing why we put a person in a particular rating classification. And we're concerned that if we can't share that information, we can't fulfill our legal obligations to our policyholders and to the regulatory bodies. Insurance companies are very protective of this health information. We aren't going to buy it from Health and Social Services. We do get an authorization from the policyholders. We're concerned a separate notice or authorization being required for specific genetic information as opposed to health information is burdensome. This would be the only state that I'm aware of that would require a separate notice. Makes it more difficult for insurers to do business here, keep track of another piece of paper. This bill would provide that that a person authorizing a collection of that data could withdraw that authorization. So now an insurance company has information in their file, they have been authorized to get that information, and all of a sudden that authorization is withdrawn. They've got to go back to the file, pull that information, take it out of the file, destroy it, return it, whatever is appropriate, and then they're not able to justify the rating classification. They can't fulfill the needs of their audit. They can't disclose appropriate information to reinsurers, and just causes a lot of serious problems. We have a problem with the definition of genetic testing and genetic analysis. We've discussed this with Senator Olson. The definitions he has are very broad and would include some tests that the general public might not consider to be a genetic test, but they would, we believe, fall within that definition. We'd like to narrow the definition so that very specific tests that are already now collected would not fall within that. In discussions with Senator Olson, I guess the feeling was that the entire bill would have to be rewritten if we changed that definition, and we haven't come to any agreement on that. But I think we're not in if I can put words in his mouth, we're probably not in disagreement about what we're talking about is protected genetic information as opposed to what would more generally fall under health information. We're concerned that if there is a separate authorization, that authorization would be drafted by Department of Health and Social Services. Insurance is regulated by the Division of Insurance, and to be then regulated by another body as well that doesn't have any knowledge of insurance would be a concern. So if there is going to be a second notice, we would prefer that that notice be drafted or at least approved by the Division of Insurance. All rates and forms are subject to a prior approval by the Division of Insurance, and so any notice that we would give authorization would also have to be approved by them. So it just makes sense that be centralized within the Division of Insurance as respects insurance companies. Be happy to answer any questions.
Senator Terrio.
Could you give us an example of the test that you think does get swept in here, that routine that we would not necessarily think of as being DNA analysis? Because it seems like the last three lines there where it says DNA analysis does not include routine physical, you know, they've swept out what I think are those routine things.
Senator Terrio, through the chair, I'm not a doctor. Been dealing with Dr. Gleason at Northwestern Mutual, and he assures me that the definition is such that it would include some tests like iron levels in the blood, and you know, any blood test, you know, potentially is a DNA test if you get the definition broad enough. I do have a proposed amendment saying what we believe DNA testing is versus generic test does not mean a routine physical measurement, test for drugs, alcohol, cholesterol, or HIV, a test performed for the purpose of diagnosing or detecting illness impairment or disorder, or a chemical, blood, or urine analysis, or other test is widely accepted and used in clinical practice. That would be our definition. And I would defer to Senator Dr. Olson, because he and Dr. Gleason have talked about the different tests, and you know, so he might be better able to answer your question than I can.
What was the broad brush at the very end, or other what?
It was actually right before or other. It was the clause between urine analysis and the final clause. That's what you added. What was that?
The last part of it.
Right after chemical blood or urine analysis. What does it say?
Or other tests that is widely accepted and in use in clinical practice.
Right before that, what's the clause before that?
Illness impairment or disorder or a chemical, blood, or urine analysis or other tests that is widely accepted and used in clinical practice.
Mr. Chairman, I'd certainly like to hear from the prime sponsor on this issue. I'm not sure. It's a rewrite of these three sentences here on page 3, lines 5 through 8. And the witness just testified about an iron test. I know my wife just went in, had her doctor, as part of a routine examination, do a test on just her iron level. You know, she's just been feeling a little bit tired. And it seems like that test, although it might not be part of a routine physical, it would be it's the routine test done to diagnosis on when somebody's experiencing tiredness. You know, the test came back and she's just a single parent. She's tired. So I don't know that wouldn't be covered by this language already, but.
Mr. Hovel will have some copies back here in just a second. What in your, you know, you have the proposed definition. Tell me what it changes. What does it substantively change?
Again, Senator, not being a doctor, you know, this was written by people at the American Council of Life Insurance and the medical doctors from the member companies. And I just don't have enough medical expertise to clearly define that, although I think Senator Olson may well, and he has had the discussion with them. So Again, he might be better able to answer that question.
Yes, Senator Terrio.
Senator Ogden.
Sorry. Thank you. Yeah, I'm kind of doing a quick read of this. Maybe Senator Olson can come up and answer.
Senator Olson, could you do that, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Donald Olson, the prime sponsor of the bill. And I guess just so we don't, it's obviously a very complicated issue here that we're dealing with. Just so I make sure that I answer the question, what specifically was the question?
Well, Senator, through the chair, Senator Olson,
go ahead.
What's RNA? I mean, that's one of the major differences in my first cursory read of this. And, you know, so they're talking about a genetic test rather than a DNA analysis, and means a test of DNA, RNA, or chromosomes performed for the purpose of identifying the presence or absence of inherited variation. I mean, there's this is a little, quite a bit different description, and includes RNA, so I have no idea.
Well, let me just start out with your first question. It's my understanding that you were asking what RNA is. It's ribonucleic acid. DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, which has to do with the biochemical difference where the obviously the oxygen are taken off from a biochemical level. But I think to answer the question in particular was there was a discussion between myself and Dr. Gleason, who lives outside the state and is their professional consultant working for the industry, and what we had discussed was this definition of genetic testing, and that was his concern. As you walk down this very complicated issue, it's you're going to have people on one side and entities on the other, whether it's the industry on one side and the ACLU on the other. It's a very quite a tightrope to go ahead and try and get a handle on it, and that's like I as point, have pointed out already, that's the reason for before we start getting off on some into real complicated biotechnological problem. And specifically where I had difficulty with the amendment related to the genetic test was that the definition as compared to what's in the bill starts to have a little bit of broader range exemptions for the insurance industry than I was willing to go ahead and take on. For example, as you go ahead and look at some of the issues here, a test performed for the purpose of diagnosis on a third to the last line there where it says tests performed for the purpose of diagnosing or detecting diseases, and then compare that with the last sentence there, the last part of the last sentence on the last line, which is widely accepted for use in clinical practice, all of a sudden the bill has no teeth to it. And so because of that, I guess I, rather than go through this whole exercise, it becomes an exercise in futility if we don't have any type of solid sentence structure that we can point to that doesn't allow for the purposes of diagnosing and detecting diseases.
Senator Olson, if I look at this, the sentence, that do you have a copy of the proposed amendment in front of you? If I look at the proposed definition, I look at starting after HIV.
Okay.
It adds a test performed for the purpose of diagnosing or detecting disease, illness, impairment, or disorder. Impairment and disorder can be genetic. Am I correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So a test to diagnose an impairment or disorder could be a DNA analysis?
Certainly could be, Mr. Chairman.
So in that case, DNA or RNA, either deoxyribonucleic or ribonucleic acid test or chromosome test, could be used to detect disorder or impairment.
and would escape this loophole. Am I correct? Or am I wrong?
It would escape the loophole?
I mean, it would escape the prohibition. It would.
Yes. It would make it too broad in my estimation of what I have in plan for the bill.
Many of the people that I know that have impairments, which is a very broad term, could be a predisposition, an impairment, under the term toward, or could be a disorder that could be detected through predisposition analysis of DNA. Am I wrong?
Mr. Chairman,
I would say that
all of us being mortal have all got some kind of impairment and disorder. And if we're not there yet, it's just not recognized, and we're headed that direction.
I'm hiding mine.
Time goes on.
I'm trying to keep mine covered up.
I'll do, Mr. Chairman. With all due respect, Mr. Chairman.
They're evident, as you say. Okay. But I think that just widens a loophole there a little too much for me. But, Senator French?
I couldn't agree more. I think you put your finger right on the difficulty there. It seems to, that definition is so broad that you go right back to, a person says, well, I did a DNA test, but it was a DNA test to find out about an impairment or a disorder, and that's allowed. And so
I have another practicing physician in the audience that I could ask to contribute here, to, but maybe not voluntarily.
If I can just make one other observation, and that is that switching to a genetic test would mean basically a rewrite of the bill, because the bill speaks throughout about a DNA analysis, and of course that's what the current definition talks about as a DNA analysis. If this definition were adopted, you'd have to go back and switch a bunch of language around to be more specific in the preceding sections.
I think we're getting a little wrapped around the axle on some of this, but I have a little concern about the broadening of the definition by the insertion of that particular sentence. Portion of the sentence. Senator Ogden?
Just an observation. I think probably professionals from both the insurance industry and the medical community are probably groaning, watching us wrestle,
right.
Us lay people wrestle with this stuff. And I'd just like to point out, I really appreciate Senator Dr. Olson, taking time from his profession and something I'm sure pays a heck of a lot more money than this does. And maybe less aggravation, I don't know, and to come down and serve in this legislature in his capacity as a senator, and it's kind of heartwarming that we have people with various expertise, and just want to point that out. I think it's a good thing. There's a lot. I'm going to get on my little soapbox here a little bit. There's some people who think it's a bad thing for people in various professions to serve, but we won't go there.
We do have someone from the Division of Insurance here with us, I believe, to provide testimony or just to observe. Ms. Campbell? Didn't come? All right. Thank you, Mr. Hope. Let's do this. I haven't heard a motion for amendment of the definition. Moving on, what's the will of the committee on the bill?
Chairman, I would move that this bill be passed on out to the next committee referral with the attached fiscal note. I would also move the letter of intent be passed on out of committee.
Use a separate motion on that.
Do one at a time?
Yeah.
One at a time. So that's there's my motion.
Is there objection to the motion to move the bill? Hearing none. The bill is moved. Is there a motion on the letter of intent drafted by Senator Terrio?
Chairman, I'd be happy to move the letter of intent if we would go to the second line and put the English nanny in me has put one apostrophe on the second to last word of the second line. I think there should be a possessive apostrophe on families before bloodlines. And if we will all agree to make that small correction, I'd be happy to make the motion to move this letter of intent with the bill.
Is there objection? Senator Terrio?
My nanny, question your nanny. Should it be just future of individual family but bloodlines? Do we need it to be possessive?
Disclosing the probable medical future of individual. No, I think you have it right. I think it's families, because we're talking about not just, and we're talking about everybody's families, the statewide families. And so I think it's the family's bloodlines. It's...
Leave it alone?
I see what you're saying. Individual family. I think it reads better the way it is.
I took English as a foreign language.
So, I think there's the correction up on line one. Have. Should be have.
Mm-hmm.
Line two, it should be apostrophe.
Family's apostrophe, bloodline. Bloodlines.
Okay. Do we have a motion to include the... Did we have the motion to include?
I moved it, yep.
Okay. With is there objection? Hearing none. Be included in the file and forwarded to the Finance Committee. So this bill, Senate Bill 217, is on to its next committee of referral. Thank you very much, Senator Olson, and all those who testified.
Senator Olson, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to do a brief...
Let's do a brief at ease, 5 minutes. Let's go back on the record. Our five-minute break went to 10, so we'll try to look here next at we're going to, and Senator Ogle will be back in just a moment, I'm sure. Did you see where he was?
He's just down the hall.
Okay. We're going to be looking here at House Bill 31, House Joint Resolution 5, and we do have a representative of the sponsor with us this morning. Welcome. Would you like to make any additional comments for us this morning?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Barry. I'm staff to Representative Williams, the sponsor of HB 31 and HJR 5. I apologize for my tardiness this morning. There was a question raised the other day by Senator Ogan, I believe, about the concept of limiting this by my constitutional amendment so that it would apply only to wildlife initiatives or initiatives having to do with wildlife. I've had the opportunity since Monday to talk to Representative Williams and to a number of the organizations and people around the state that have shown support for this amendment over the years, and it's my understanding that Representative Williams had an opportunity also to speak with Senator Ogan. This is a piece of legislation, and indeed a constitutional amendment, as I think most of the committee members know, that Representative Williams has been working on for coming up on 6 years now. And the current version that you see before you is something that's been, there have been various suggestions over the years to change it to apply to different sorts of things or to change some of the numbers. And the current version is the one, you know, that has developed the support it has over the course of these years. The representative is reluctant to make any more changes at this point, having done so much work to get the kind of support that he's gotten over the years. The suggestion to limit it only to wildlife initiatives, while there was comment, there was discussion the other day, Mr. Chairman, in indicating that the wildlife initiatives are certainly a large concern of supporters of this amendment. There are other sorts of issues that have come up over the years and might come up in future years that have helped generate support for this amendment from other parts of the state and other groups in the state. And again, Representative Williams, I think, has some concern about what kind of statewide support might be lost if you limited it only to that issue. It's an important issue to a lot of people around the state for a lot of different reasons. And I'm open to questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Barry, I'll have to ask your forgiveness for me not being here Monday, so I didn't hear the initial presentation on the bill. Could you just give me a little bit of a rundown on how the two pieces of legislation work together? One's a bill, one's a resolution, one's going to go in front of the people for ratification, of course, and the statute. I mean, how does that work? How do those two go together? Why does it require two pieces of legislation, not just one?
Through the chair, Senator French, the Alaska State Constitution has language setting out the procedure by which an initiative is to get to the ballot, and in addition, there's statutory language about how that process will work. So in order to make this change, you'd have to change the statute as well as the Constitution. HB 31 is the statutory change. HJR 5, and the statutory change is contingent on the passage of an amendment to the Constitution at the polls this fall, and HJR 5 is the resolution that would put that constitutional amendment on the ballot.
And if I took your earlier comment correctly, because I've been curious about, you know, what specific issues are troublesome, what specific issues are problematic, you know, what initiatives are coming forward that are, you know, not fairly representative of, you know, the state. I mean, I understand the concern of the legislation. The concern of legislation is that Anchorage voters, Anchorage, you know, home people who get petitions signed out in front of Home Depot and Walmart drive the initiative process, whereas folks who live out in the bush don't ever get to participate, with the exception, I guess, of one voter from each, or one voter from a district. And so if it's wildlife initiatives and something else, what's that something else? Can you give me some idea about what the concern of the sponsors are?
Through the chair, Senator French, some of the testimony we've had and the support we've had has been driven, I think, by things that have happened or attempts.
A good illustration of that, maybe to shorten that, Senator French, in your packet, you have a number of sheets from a number of different initiatives with gray shaded areas to show what districts were there and what districts were not there in bringing the initiative to the ballot. And the concern basically is that the primary movers of initiatives that get on the ballot are the urban areas, and that there's really very little inclusion of the folks in the rural area in the initial question. Am I correct? And I agree with that premise. I think that by expanding the requirement for a wider cross-section of the community to include the more of the rural folks that are out there is a more fair and balanced way to be able to look at bringing the initiative to the eventual ballot. But I think that's probably the most, if you're looking for terms of illustration, they're in the packet.
Did you want to add anything to that?
Just very briefly, through the chair, Senator French. We've heard from a lot of people who are concerned about what might happen, looking at states like California, where really the legislature's hands are tied by the initiative process, as well as, and there are certain issues, certainly Senator Ogans can speak more eloquently than I about the concerns of a lot of people in the state about wildlife initiatives, about out-of-state organizations coming in and essentially creating an issue that's not of a lot of concern to a lot of Alaskans. There was a discussion on the floor of the House when this was being debated from some rural legislators about the English-only initiative that came up a few years back. Of course, down in this part of the state, you'll hear from a lot of people who are concerned about capital move initiatives. There are a lot of different kinds of issues, I think, that we've heard from people around the state that have come up or might come up that are not viewed as being representative of the state as a whole.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Further discussion, is there any other testimony? Anyone else want to testify on this bill? Seeing no one here, is anyone online? No one online, public testimony is closed. Further discussion among the members? Will of the committee?
Chairman, I would move House Joint Resolution Number 5 from committee with the attached fiscal notes.
Senator Terrio, within its recommendations, is there objection?
Sure.
Senator Ogan.
Just like to put something on the record before we move the bill.
Please go ahead, Mr. Senator Ogan.
I am sure that there will be those that will frame this argument that this is a legislative power grab, that this is an attempt to end run the will of the voters. But I just want to make it very clear for the record that I feel this goes a long way to help with the perception of disenfranchisement of rural Alaskans and the will of the urban areas being foisted upon a minority group of people. And I'm not talking racially, I'm just talking geographic minority. And I think this will go a long way to help close that perceived gap. And those are my motivations. The voters do have a very clear choice in this. It's not undoing the will of the voters at all, because the voters have to vote to approve it. And if the people believe this is a good thing, then they will approve it by majority vote. So just wanted to put that on the record, because I can already, I've been around this mulberry bush a couple of times, and I know what the criticism is going to be, and I don't see this as being a legislative power grab at all. This is more, you know, I think that when the Constitution was framed and the geographical issues were envisioned, it was a whole different set of demographics than are in place in the state today. I think this accurately takes into account the shift in demographics towards the urban areas in Alaska, and more accurately reflects the will of people throughout the state, rather than Anchorage or Mad Valley or Fairbanks or the populated areas dictating by initiative to the unpopulated areas and having maybe their will foisted upon them, rather than a consensus, a broad consensus of the state. But having said that, I just wanted to put that on the record, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Ogden. I agree. Anything that we can do to include those people who are geographically inaccessible in the decision-making process, and even in the bringing of the question to the rest of the voters on the ballot, is a worthwhile effort, and I think opens, tries at least, and is an attempt to try to make our political process more inclusive. And so I agree with that. Further discussion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing none, this bill and this resolution are moved on. Oh, Senator Terrio, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I only move the resolution, so I would now make a motion to move House Bill 31 from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal.
Objection. Hearing none, the resolution and the bill are moved on to the next stop on the referral process. Thank you for your time here today. Okay, Representative Seaton, you've been patient all morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee.
We're looking at House Bill 260.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You asked at the last meeting four questions, and the first of those was, if a nurse follows a negligent order of a doctor immunized under this bill, would the nurse have immunity, and could the hospital or nonprofit be liable? And the research shows that this bill does not change the liability for the nurse. The nurse is only liable for her actions if they're negligent, and cannot be held liable for negligence of another. If, however, the nurse should have known of a negligent order of the doctor was incorrect, but based on her standard of expertise, then the nurse is negligent, and also under respondeat superior. And also, the medical facility or organization could be held liable as well. There is some case history, and I provide you with supporting documents on that in the legal memo there of February 27th. Do you want me to go through all the questions first, or do you want to?
We'll go right ahead. And if there's questions in our committee, if a member has a question, it's allowable for them to raise their hand and intervene.
If the doctor is volunteering medical services aboard a cruise ship, could the cruise ship be considered compensation for travel and expenses? This bill is drafted so that the immunity is only provided when the volunteer services are provided in a medical facility owned or operated by a governmental agency or a nonprofit. You know, a court decision would have to show that the medical facility on board the cruise ship was owned or operated by a governmental agency or nonprofit. And although that seems unlikely, you know, language could be changed to insert that only facilities land-based, or you could have in there that compensation for travel could be limited to not include cruises. The only caution I put on that is we could have a situation in which we had a medical ship functioning like we did actually, I think, during the Prince William Sound oil spill at Exxon Valdez, or you could have some broad-based infection or something in Southeastern where a ferry would be used, or a cruise ship might be, you know, come online in an emergency situation. And so that's just a, but it would, again, have to be operated by government or a nonprofit. So I don't see that as likely, but you know, that could be fixed. But I see problems with the fix as well, because it takes away some emergency situations that we might encounter. The third question was, do all Alaska hospitals require physicians to have medical liability insurance before they are given hospital privileges? And if so, could the doctor operating in a hospital take advantage of immunity provided under this act? And most hospitals in Alaska do, but Alaska Regional Hospital does not require physicians to have medical liability. So if a hospital does require insurance, they would have to have specific provisions in their hospital bylaws to accommodate the usage of of this facility. Now, this wouldn't apply to nurses, from what we heard from the testimony from the Nurses Association, because they generally advise all the nurses to carry liability. Most nurses do not carry personal liability insurance and rely on the facility protections. So I think that, you know, we have a little different situation in doctors than we do in other healthcare professionals there. But again, if the hospital does not require, or if a hospital does require a liability insurance before practice, then they would have to have something in their bylaws to make a change to allow this to occur. The last question was, do all nonprofits have insurance? And no, there's no mandatory insurance law in Alaska for healthcare providers in the state, and except for emergency room physicians. But recognizing that a nonprofit could be held liable for their employees and volunteers, a medical nonprofit organization would want to protect itself from liability. And further than that, we have Donald Bullock from Legislative Legal Affairs or Legal Services online with the details. I'm not a lawyer. And we also have Mike Hogan here who's the Executive Director of Alaska Physicians of the Surgeons Association. So I hope that answers the questions.
Questions for the sponsor, Senator Ogun.
Thank you. We had some discussion, I believe, about there's a physician who is immune from liability because of a direct order and a paid staff person. To a paid staff person, is that staff person immune from liability as well? And we also have a legal opinion here from, I think you saw it on that issue. Do you care to discuss that?
Yes, I think that we were mainly talking about a nurse that was executing a doctor's orders, and she would not assume liability for a doctor's orders unless within the scope of her knowledge and her experience and the scope of her expertise, she should have known that this was an incorrect order. And then she would have liability because she's acting within the scope of her expertise against her own expertise. So she could pick up some liability that way. But otherwise, she wouldn't have liability from the doctor.
So if she refused a doctor's order, and later it was shown that she was trying to be precautionary within the scope of her authority and she was wrong, then she'd have some liability.
I have to talk to the lawyers about that, Senator Seekins. I'm sorry, I can't.
Thank you. Senator Ogun.
The legal opinion talks about whether or not the nonprofit organization would be liable. And, you know, I think there may be some concerns that the insurance that nonprofit may go up if that particular volunteer doctor is not covered, that, you know, there is some liability for the organization, I believe, that they're volunteering for. Well, the doctor might be immune. Maybe that organization might assume more liability, and I don't know if there's a possibility of their insurance costs going up because of that or not. Well, care to respond?
Through the chair, Senator Rogan, I believe that nonprofits and government agencies would want to carry their own liability in any case, whether it's a doctor that's volunteering or a doctor that's not volunteering. I mean, because they also can have vicarious liability based on if they have a physician, whether he's a volunteer or not, who is not really qualified or has had, you know, problems or charges, or that he doesn't have a current license, or you're asking him to perform work outside of his expertise, then vicarious liability is going to come in for that entity that is sponsoring the work. So I don't know that that's going to change as far as the necessity for a nonprofit to carry insurance.
Okay. Further questions, Senator Rogan? Representative Seaton, between the last time we heard this bill and today, I had a call from a constituent who asked me a question that I couldn't answer. I thought I might know the answer, but I agreed to pose the question to you this morning. And that is, under this law, if a doctor were to perform an abortion in a nonprofit clinic of some form, is he immune from any liability?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill only covers illness or injury. Okay, so what you would have to do is have a legal definition that a pregnancy is an illness or an injury before this would ever apply. So this does not apply in the case of an abortion, because there, at least to my knowledge, there's never been a classification that pregnancy is an illness or an injury.
My wife always said she wasn't sick, she was just pregnant.
Senator, we did talk about this extensively in House Judiciary, and it was determined that that was covered, because this bill does not cover that situation for abortion.
Right. And that's not your intent here?
It's not my intent, and that was, like I say, fully discussed in House Judiciary as well.
Thank you very much. Other questions? So we have a couple of people that want to testify. But personally, I like the intent. I just don't know what the unintended consequences for all the parties will be. And in some respect, I suppose that may be up to them to defend themselves from any potential liability, as long as what we're doing is good public policy, and most healthcare providing organizations have lawyers on staff or on call. So I applaud what you're trying to do. I think it's important that we try to look at some of the unintended consequences, as my friend Senator Rogan calls them. Senator, did you have a question? Okay.
Senator Seaton, I might just add that I think that that's pretty well set out to each one of those agencies, because there must be this written notification at the time of or prior to receiving medical treatment required in this bill.
Let's just go to testimony now, if we can. We have three people that have indicated they wanted to testify on this bill. First, we'll go to Joan Fisher in Anchorage. Are you there, Joan?
Yes, I'm here.
If you'll put yourself on the record, we'll be eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Chairman Speaker. My name is Joan Fisher. I'm the Executive Director at Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center. ANHC is 330 Community Health Center in Anchorage, and we serve primarily low-income and uninsured individuals. And we support House Bill 260. Often we have physicians or mid-levels that would like to volunteer at our clinic, maybe do an afternoon a week or an evening. And our health center We have FTCA coverage, it's Federal Claims Tort Act coverage, and it covers physicians who are employed or contracted by the center, but it does not cover volunteers. And even though oftentimes a lot of volunteers have their own medical liability coverage, there are times when they don't. And where we run into that most often is when they're returning Indian Health Service physicians who have lived in Alaska for many years. They were covered through FTCA through the Indian Health Service, and they don't carry medical liability, but they're still a licensed physician in Alaska. And so when we have volunteers come into our clinic, or a lot of times they go into the shelters, which we go into homeless shelters, first of all, we credential them. We look to make sure that they have a valid license, medical license, and we look at to see what their past liability might have been, if they have claims against them. Oftentimes, we don't allow them to come in and volunteer. So we're very careful about who we allow into our clinics to volunteer, and that includes, you know, nursing staff. You know, we hope that if they will have coverage. But this helps us to see patients who are uninsured, very low income, that can't afford, you know, costly physician care. And so volunteers can come in for a half day or an evening and see patients. Another reason why I'd like to support this bill is that we're trying to set up a volunteer provider network here in Anchorage. As you know, the uninsured population is growing nationally and locally, and more and more physicians or providers, mid-levels, are willing to see patients on a volunteer basis, but they're afraid to because of the liability issue. And in order to set up this volunteer network, I think we really need to have this bill in place.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Any questions from the members? Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Joan. Senator Ogden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have any concerns about if you have somebody operating in your clinic on a volunteer basis and they don't, they're have immunity because of this bill, that it might incur increase in cost of insurance to your organization? It's basically you've got somebody with a get out of jail free card that's working there, and, or at least get out of tort free card, and you're going to assume the responsibility for that due to the fact that they're working under your umbrella.
Through the chair, Senator Ogden, no, I don't have concern about that necessarily. We have Federal Claims Tort Act coverage, which means that we're covered by the government, and we don't pay for medical liability. But we would not want to volunteer in our clinic that did not give quality care, and we are responsible for our patients. They are our patients. We would have their medical chart in our clinic, and so if a provider were to, you know, make a mistake, hopefully it wouldn't be gross negligence, but you know, if there is a mistake, our quality control or our quality assurance would hopefully pick that up and either, you know, dismiss the volunteer or address the issue in the best way that we can. I mean, it may fall back to the clinic that we would be liable because we had that volunteer, but hopefully through the credentialing process prior to their volunteering and then any quality oversight that we have, we would be able to spot providers that, you know, were not giving good care.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Let's move next to the off-net that we have Donald Bullock. Donald, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm just available for questions.
Okay.
Question sponsor.
Thank you very much. Dr. Schumacher. Dr. Schumacher, are you there?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello, this is Dr. Kathy Schumacher. I'm chair of the Anchorage Access to Healthcare Coalition, which is a group of people working to improve access to healthcare for people in Anchorage. And we very much support House Bill 260. It would allow physicians in good faith to volunteer their time without fear of litigation. We, as Joan said, we're working with Joan to work on this volunteer network based on a model developed in Asheville, North Carolina. And they do have a very similar law to this in place that allows the network to function. So it really refers to personal physician liability, the malpractice, which is quite expensive. And the language of the bill talks about retired physicians who might want to continue to see people on a volunteer basis but would not want to keep paying premiums. And it really isn't designed to be a license for bad doctors to practice. These are people who are going to volunteer their time. So I think for the most part, they're going to be very good doctors who care about the community and want to give back to the community. And this bill will allow that to happen.
Questions for Dr. Schumacher? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony this morning.
Welcome.
Dr. Hogan, I noticed you've been becoming a regular here in the halls of the legislature lately. I wonder if I could ask you if you could maybe come and just answer a couple of questions for me.
Sure. I'm not a doctor. I must preface that.
That's right. You're not. You are. That's right. Mr. Hogan. Mr. Hogan, you play one on TV. That's correct. I wonder, question. As you look at this bill, and you're looking at, you're representing the physicians of the state of Alaska, your organization at least, and it's true, the first section talks about retired physicians, but as I look at the second section of the bill, it exempts any physician volunteering. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So, are we looking at from the medical community's perspective, is this a way, are doctors generally in support of being able to provide volunteer care without having to burden their malpractice coverage? Is this part of what this bill is about?
I don't think that was necessarily intent. The doctors that are actively practicing medicine are going to carry liability insurance anyway.
Anyhow.
This would allow them to go to a village while they're currently practicing and volunteer their services. But like you said, they're going to be carrying malpractice insurance anyway. This really started with some of my more senior doctors who are getting close to retirement. They're in their 60s, and they're looking for ways to keep their hand in. And it was actually my association who started this process, and it was based on a desire from quite a few of my senior doctors to want to give back to the community. So we emphasized the retired physician component of it, but we broadened it to include a lot of different healthcare providers because there was a desire by other constituencies to do that.
So it looks to me, though, here, and I'm not arguing against this, but I think I want to point it out for the record. And so I'm wondering about your analysis of the bill and you representing your group of physicians. It appears, and the sponsors here as well, is that any health care provider who provides health care services to another person is not liable for civil damages resulting from an act or omission if they're doing it on a volunteer basis.
And there's informed consent.
And informed consent.
Right.
So, I agree with that, but I just want on the record that it's not just retired physicians, and Representative Seaton, I'm eager to include your comments on the record as well.
Thank you. I would just like to expand that they have to be providing it under the auspices of a nonprofit or governmental agency. So it's not just somebody operating out of their garage.
No.
This has to be under the auspices of an agency. So there is some, liability chain there as well.
So it provides them the opportunity to do some pro bono work without incurring any liability.
Except in the case of gross negligence.
Right, gross negligence.
They're subject to all kinds of
I understand
domestic
that.
Consequences.
Everything is gross negligence to the plaintiff's attorney. So.
And might I just add, only if they're operating within the scope of their license.
Right.
And they have to be currently licensed.
That's just all I wanted to make sure that we understood it. It is providing a public service, and we're encouraging people to do that by removing some of the liability or the threat of lawsuit for other than gross negligence.
Can I clarify one point?
Please,
about the very first question? I think this is important to get it on the record. Alaska is a several liability state, so if you imagine in a potential lawsuit a pie and divide it in thirds, and you put a doctor in one third, say a nurse in a third, and the facility in a third, this bill does not increase the potential liability for the nurse or the hospital. What it does is remove the doctor's pro rata share of a potential judgment. So, in other words, the nurse is only responsible for her breach of her...
It's not joint and several, it's several.
It's just several. So this should not increase the liability at all for the nurse or the facility.
Thank you. Ogun. Senator Ogun, questions?
Thank you. I just think that this is a great bill, and this is going to go a long way to utilize that years of expertise, especially the guys that have this this knowledge and training and wish to do something with it after they're retired and keep their hand in it and keep current. My wife just got back from Guatemala with my daughter on a mission trip, and the fact that the healthcare down there is non-existent. I mean, it's, you know, if you have a problem, it's, you know, you deal with it, and it's, you know, it runs its natural course, you know, whether you die or not, but there's very, very little medical care, especially in the rural areas, and there's a real absence of medical care in rural Alaska, and you know, living with a serious medical condition here myself the last few years, I kind of appreciate being close to medical help where I could get it, because I'm simply, frankly, I'm alive because of it, you know. So just I think this is a good thing. I think it's still a long ways to help them. Alaskans that can't afford medical care, it's so expensive, and people in rural Alaska, so it's probably one of the more humanitarian things we could probably do, in my opinion, in this session. So,
other questions of the gentleman? I also appreciate, my wife is a registered nurse and has kept her license up in the state of Alaska for many years, doing mainly volunteer work. Because she can do that a little more on her schedule than on someone else's, and does a tremendous amount of work with, particularly with young people in a volunteer capacity. And so I see the need, I understand the opportunity, and I think it's good for the state of Alaska to encourage medical professionals of any kind to be there. So in some respect, for the record, I want you to know that even though it's my wife, she lives with me, so there could be a conflict in this.
I object.
Okay.
But
I know many other people that she associates with who volunteer their medical expertise from time to time to help in situations where people cannot pay or otherwise would not receive any medical attention. Just in screening what she does in trying to help find, detect, or in early detection, things in kids in schools to be able to get through that process where she volunteers a lot of her time, and other people do as well. I think that this is a good bill. I'm surprised that we haven't addressed this a long time ago. But then you weren't here a long time ago, Representative Seaton. So, with that, is there any other questions for either Mr. Hogan or Representative Seaton?
Hearing none, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else that wishes to testify online? Do we have anyone in the audience here in Juneau who wishes to testify on this bill? Hearing none, we've closed public testimony. Any further discussion? Senator Ogden?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate CS for CS for House Bill 260, version B is in Victor, with individual recommendations attached. Fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Hearing none. House Bill 260 is moved on to the next committee or next stop in the referral process. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us this morning.